Up next on Technometria, Scott and I talk with Jeff Pappas about his new book, Glitch, The Impact of Faulty Software, from IT Conversations. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks again for having us.
Oh, it's great to have you. And Scott, welcome to you as always.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here.
So Jeff, the occasion that brings us together today is the publication of your new book, Glitch, The Hidden Impact of Faulty Software. And you start the book with the story of a guy named Jeff Muzinski, who I think I remember hearing about this on the news when it happened. Can you tell us that story?
Well, this is one of those stories that, you know, was followed by a rash of kind of mainstream media broadcast headlines. This guy, you know, was at a gas station and made an insignificant, you know, sort of $5 purchase and found that his debit account had been hit for $23 quadrillion and change.
Which is a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, more than the national debt. The amazing thing is the bank processed it. It took, you know, several weeks of back and forth on the part of this poor consumer to sort of deduce what was happened. And of course, the problem then continued to plague him for months and probably years because it drained all of his accounts, you know, automatic payments and stuff, given the electronic nature of the way mm-hmm. all of our mm-hmm. sort of bank accounts are wired today began to bounce. And, you know, the thing cascaded for a good long time. And, you know, you went through this unfortunate period of time between the credit card company and the bank. Everyone pointed fingers at one another. But the bottom line is, this was obviously an automated IT problem as opposed to human errors. Humans, you know, I'll tell you, without being abashed about it, I couldn't figure out how many zeros are in that number.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's amazing.
The thing that's scary and interesting at the same time about this story is the cascading effect. You know, it's one thing to think, oh, your bank could make an error and they put, you know, a huge amount on your debit a huge amount from your account. But like you say, I mean, it's all connected together. So you miss a payment and then those people assess a late payment and you got to somehow connect, you know, well, the bank made this problem. And how do you get the other company to accept the fact that you didn't cause I can just imagine the grief that it caused.
What makes it all the scarier is the propensity for this kind of thing. I mean, you know, type the term computer glitch in your Google search alert engine and see how many of these things you get a day. I mean, last week we had another major bank, name escapes me at the moment, who, you know, basically truncated all of their customers' online banking capacity for, it's been about 11 days now. We had a similar instance 3 or 4 weeks previous to that when, on the basis of a merger with Commerce Bank and TD Bank, you know, those customers were locked out of their ATM network for days. And in a like manner to the first story you mentioned from Chapter 1, in that particular instance, you had the same kind of, you know, automatic payroll deposits don't happen, automatic payments don't happen, credit scores get affected. You know, the basic premise for the book is that we've reached this information technology perfect storm where, you know, a bunch of things that converge, and one of which is the saturation or ubiquity or complexity of the technology, you know, kind of curve. And, you know, you don't have to be one of us that has spent your life in the industry. Now it's affecting everyday life and everyday consumers. And we've reached the saturation point where, you know, the potential for the digital version of a Pearl Harbor is here.
That's an interesting comment because I think, you know, we all are familiar with various computer glitches, you know, causing some kind of grief in our lives. Probably happened to almost everybody. And I want to talk a little bit about, that idea, the idea that glitches are on the rise. But you're saying that it's something more. It's not just like this kind of linear progression. And yeah, there's a few more than last year and a few more than the year before that and, you know, so on. But that we're actually reaching a tipping point of sorts.
I think there's three things combining to create this perfect storm I spoke of. One's the sheer ubiquity of technology. You know, as of February of 2010, we had 1 trillion devices connected to the internet for the first time. You know, probably the greater percentage of them, you know, mobile handheld devices. But that's an incredible number if you think about it. You know, at the same time, We've got more than 1 billion embedded microprocessors for every human being on the planet as of the eclipse of the last quarter.
Say that again. Did I hear that number right?
1 billion embedded microprocessors or transistors for every human being on the planet.
Wow.
The ubiquity of things. And, you know, you see it whether you realize it every day in your own lives, because think about your own broadband experience. I mean, I love the iPhone. I'm a huge Apple fan. I think all of us are slaves to our smartphones. But the number of calls I drop and the number of incidents of less than perfect fidelity that you or I experience every day now is dramatically worse than 4 years ago. And it's not because Apple built a bad product or over some, you know, sort of antenna malfunction. It's because we have saturated the amount of broadband capacity that we have. You know, so you put together that, let's call it technology saturation or complexity curve. You couple that with the fact that we've got a major loss in intellectual capital. And what I mean by that is, for the first time in our lifetimes, I'm 56 and I've been in the industry for 30 years now, between the downturn in graduating math and computer science majors, the other side of the dot-com bubble, which is down 37% as it happens, and the fact that for the first time in our lives, the bulk of our COBOL and Fortran programmers are retiring or, you know, sad to say, dying and not being replaced, means that the bulk of our back-end transaction processing systems, which record about 74% of the world's financial transactions, it's not, you know, it's not hip to think about it, but the IBM mainframe is still the workhorse of transaction processing. And all of that codified human capital and working knowledge of all of those applications, which probably represent 70 or 80% of our applications inventory, are being impacted by the fact that those people, you know, are no longer working or no longer exist.
Yeah.
And they're not being replaced.
That's a remarkable idea, because I was the CIO for the state of Utah, which is, you know, admittedly, we had a lot of COBOL programs. And I guess I kind of thought maybe we were unique. I mean, you know, I was sure that old line, you know, companies like banks and power companies and stuff probably had COBOL programs too, but I didn't realize the extent of that. You say in a book that, I'm just going to read a little thing from page 7. Micro Focus International has found that COBOL applications are involved in transporting up to 72,000 shipping containers, caring for 60 million patients, processing 80% of point-of-sale transactions, and connecting 500 million mobile phone users. So when my Apple iPhone, the latest in technology, drops a call, it could be because we don't have enough COBOL programmers.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about. Now, so let follow the thread. So we've got the saturation of technology, or this technology complexity curve, as I called it. We've got this loss of human capital. And the third substrate is the fact that we've had this propensity for mergers and acquisitions in the financial services sector since the 2008 economic downturn. And we have the added challenge of merging all these massive back-end systems with all of these financial services companies that are joining, you know, whether it's, you know, Morgan and Stanley, or I mean Pickett, there's a million of them, you know, Wachovia and Wells Fargo, it goes on and on and on. You put all of that stuff together, and it's no surprise that we're experiencing a disruption in both business and consumption that we've never seen the likes of previous to this point.
Yeah, that's a an interesting pattern of events. The COBOL thing is kind of interesting to me, and I don't want to just dwell on it because I think the other two we ought to talk about too. But the idea that obviously there are people who learned how to program long ago and they're baby boomers and they're retiring. I mean, I don't think that's a surprise to many people. But I mean, if what you're saying is that we need to be training new COBOL programmers at a rate far exceeding what we are.
We do. And you know, it's not fashionable. I mean, the kids coming out of college that are, you know, sort of destined to be the next, you know, sort of Facebook founders or whatever are much more interested in social media and Java and C Sharp and lots of other things, sort of understandably. But, you know, the overwhelming majority, I mean, pick your number, but the overwhelming majority of our existing applications inventory that runs our, you know, our critical infrastructures are COBOL-based, mainframe-based applications, and who's going to care for that critical resource?
You know, it's kind of interesting. You sit there and start to wonder, is there some market to somehow also provide tools that would be more attractive? I mean, it's funny to think of a cross-compiler to COBOL or something, you know, that would somehow bridge that gap, and whether or not it's even possible.
Well, you know, it's interesting. People have talked about various, you know, let's call them mainframe modernization technologies where you'd migrate things from COBOL to Java and stuff. And the reality is that that's probably not technically viable. I mean, you know, there's a number of things if we all think about it. We've all been around, if you go back through the history of our industry, that we're going to be the next great things that failed, you know, pen computing. Very few people remember this, but, you know, the advent of the social interface, what Microsoft used to call Bob, which was this graphically depicted sort of image of an office where you'd literally open a file drawer or pick up a pen to get to Word and stuff. I mean, you know, artificial intelligence probably tops that list. And about the only thing we've done with inference engines is voice response systems for 411 that aggravate the crap out of all of us on a daily basis because they typically don't work. And the notion that we're going to build a giant inference engine that's somehow going to demystify, let's face it, what's largely more art than science in terms of the lack of structure in trillions of lines of COBOL is, you know, it's just an oxymoron. It's just not going to happen. That's a human intensive effort, and we're not growing the human capacity to deal with it.
Yeah. Are we seeing an uptick in the market? Have you seen or tracked anything like that where, you know, there's increased salaries for these kinds of skills or something that might start to attract more people into it?
Well, I think there are, like any kind of supply and demand you know, situation, you're going to see, you know, companies pay through the nose where necessary to retain those skills longer. IBM, for its part, I had this conversation with Steve Mills, runs all of IBM software. They've got programs now in 600 universities where they're sponsoring curriculums and stuff to try to accelerate the growth of programmers coming out of universities, young people, that have COBOL skills. And you can imagine that those COBOL programmers are having a far easier time in this economy, you know, finding new jobs than perhaps people that are doing, you know, hipper, cooler things that can't find them. So there's a number of things being done to counteract it. And IBM, you know, obviously has a vested interest in this. And you've got to say they're philanthropically throwing a lot of money at the problem and doing the right things, but the scale of the problem almost defies imagination.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating thought that we need more COBOL programmers. I can't quite wrap my head around it, and I guess that's part of the problem.
It is. It is, and it's one of these things until things start breaking and ATM networks are inaccessible and whatnot, then, you know, you have to sort of trace the sort of breadcrumb trail back to the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is the maturation or the aging of the codified human knowledge that created all that infrastructure in the first place.
I guess that's what's interesting is where that then ties into sort of these problems that start to emerge as those older systems integrate with newer systems or newer forms, types of data or whatever interact with these old systems, which then all of a sudden can cause some very interesting breakdowns.
Well, yeah, think about the strain on all. I mean, you know, originally, I mean, we've gone through three or four waves of technology we've all been around for. The first thing we did was we automated back office tasks like payroll and general ledger systems and stuff. And, you know, over a couple of decades, we called them ERP systems and other things. But those were the things that computers did originally. I don't think that it was ever in the sort of founding, you know, fathers' kinds of imaginations that we'd be accessing all of those things with our our wireless-based, you know, smartphones and search engines and stuff, and yet all of that data ultimately populates many of the coolest, hippest applications that we carry around in our pockets. So you have that added stress or that added dimension. But even in their original codification or their original form, you know, all of the immense amounts of transaction, you know, centric applications, excuse me, I have to turn this phone off. You know, none of those things went away. All of those existing applications, you know, need to be cared for. I'm willing to bet, and this is, I'll tell you, not a perfectly scientific number, but I bet 75% of our existing information technology resources in Fortune 2000 companies today are necessary to maintain the existing applications that currently exist, never mind the ever-growing backlog or demand for, you know, new portals and new applications and new projects. And, you know, the other side of the recession, you know, we no longer have infinite resources or blank checks or, you know, the capacity to just continue to hire to stay ahead of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's definitely an issue there in terms of efficiency and like you say, staying ahead of the problem as opposed to just even trying to get out from underneath of it. You know, another one of the issues you mentioned is this problem with mergers, and some companies know how to do mergers and some companies don't. I mean, like I know that Cisco has always been hailed as a company that was, you know, they have like a whole merger team that manages the whole thing. And, you know, I'm sure they make some mistakes too. But, you know, other times, like especially now, as we see the financial companies more or less merging out of necessity, I'm sure there have just been some really horrific stories around the technology side of that.
Oh, there clearly are. I mean, I experienced one of the biggest mergers in our industry, you know, firsthand when IBM bought Lotus. And I mean, think about it for a second, guys. I mean, can you imagine two, at least on the surface, you know, more polarized cultures? It wasn't like all of us in Cambridge were sitting in the sort of cross-legged position humming with our Hawaiian shirts on, which I think a lot of people suppose, but we weren't wearing blue suits and white shirts and ties either. Mm-hmm. And to Lou Gerstner's credit, who was the chairman of IBM at the time, he went to extremes to create, you know, kind of a social context where the best of those cultures merged. And that was probably one of the more complex and larger scale mergers central to our industry. And it worked. When you think about what's happening with financial services companies, first of all, as you said, they're being merged in some cases out of necessity. They're not as concerned as IBM and Lotus would have been about trying to find a way to keep the innovation and all those other things that are part of the subjective value of those enterprises together. They're simply trying to make those systems work. And the first thing that happens in mergers of that kind is you start harvesting the middle part of the income statement, which is a nice way of saying you can a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any way to do that well or to do it particularly scientifically. And the consequence of that, and I've talked to CIO after CIO involved in the middle of this, is like when I throw that switch and all of this stuff is supposed to work together, you know, there's 30 million lines of code being intermingled here, and I haven't a clue whether it's going to work or not. And we're seeing the ramifications of it.
Yeah, and you know, I have had opportunity to meet some of the CIOs in some of the larger financial shops as well, and you know, a lot of these places are pretty well run. You know, they're not sloppy, but still, you know, the merger of two different IT cultures and very disparate systems just is not an easy thing to get right.
It's not. And remember, one of the first places that things began to get outsourced, meaning, you know, projects and quality assurance efforts or other pieces of our critical processes, you know, get sent overseas, was in financial services. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It would be hard enough anyway, but now you've got the added, you know, time lapse dimension and asynchronous communication and culture and language adding to the complexity of all of this. I mean, you're absolutely right. These are brilliant people. These are not astute organizations, but it's incredibly hard to get all of those pieces right.
So that said, do you have any advice for companies undergoing mergers to help reduce glitches?
Well, the overarching prescriptive in the book is that all of the problems we're discussing, inclusive of this issue of jamming together all these back offices, are not problems we're going to solve by working harder or just adding more people. In a sense, we have to eat our own cooking as an industry. We've got to innovate and turn technology back on ourselves and automate the sort of best practices and policies and the codification of our scrutiny of these infrastructures, because you cannot involve enough human capital in this problem to avoid the sort of pitfalls that are making the broadcast news cycles every day. So, a lot of the pieces of artificial intelligence and a lot of the frameworks and governance platforms and other technologies that we've been developing, have got to be organized in a way where we automate our ability to sort through these tens of millions of lines of code and instances like the ones we're discussing, because we're sure as heck not going to be lucky enough to do this with an extra 100 people there and an extra 100 people there. And if we don't continue to innovate as an industry, the information technology industry, which has been a major growth engine of the economy and a major boost to our productivity in the context of, a GMP story, is going to suffer.
Let's talk for a second about the third idea, ubiquity of technology. You opened up with the story of the 24 quadrillion debit to somebody's card, and you could imagine that even 5 or 10 years ago, that sort of thing would have been caught by some human in the loop, right? That somebody would have said, "Wait a minute, there's something wrong here." But we've actually gotten to one of the things we celebrate, in fact, is this idea that we are more and more automated. And what that's done is it's taken some of the fire breaks out of the loop, as it were, that when a mistake happens, it just goes all the way to the end and nobody ever sees it.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't know if you remember this, but there was a movie came out years ago. I'm going to date myself now. The star of the movie was Matthew Broderick back when he was younger. And the movie was called War Games.
Yep.
And he broke into this, what he thought, online gaming system with his telephone modem from his bedroom as a high school student, and called up this menu of what he thought were, games to be played, one of which was thermal nuclear warfare. And because the Department of Defense and the premise of this story had taken all of the humans out of the missile silos and automated everything, unwittingly, he tipped off the U.S.'s DEFCON system, and the movie carried the storyline of him, starting with hacking into his high school curriculum and, changing his girlfriend's grades to putting Russia and the U.S. at nuclear odds with one another because the human beings were out of the switch and the missile silos were all following the instructions of this computer. And it was a cute story, and it all ended with him convincing the computer system to play tic-tac-toe. And the moral of the story was, that's a game that nobody ever wins, and thermal nuclear war is also a game that nobody wins. And that's how they avoided disaster. But our financial systems in the world today follow much the same storyline. We do not have the human, intervention. Things are completely automated. So to the point of the $24 quadrillion gas station purchase, there is nobody in the loop to say, well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, the recent example just a couple of weeks ago when the stock market lost, 4% of its value in an afternoon because of an automated trading system that kind of kicked off. And it was in the span of, I think, about 3 minutes before humans got involved and arrested the automated trading. Well, exactly the same scenario.
Yeah, and that's a system where people are watching it all the time. Something like my bank balance, I watch it once a week or so. That's so I'm not likely to see those problems as quickly.
No, exactly.
So you talk about, we talk about the idea of, well, you know, you, there's this ripple effect. You get this 24 quadrillion charge and it causes you some grief in your life. And that's all, you know, we don't like that, but there's more to it than just some inconvenience at stake here. You talk about both the software that is in cars and the software we use to manage our healthcare as being places where we could particularly be at risk.
Oh, yeah. The stories in the book and Glitch about the healthcare industry is a really graphic example. I mean, we tend as human beings, first of all, to think of our medical professionals, doctors in particular, as kind of godlike and infallible. As consumers, many of us, particularly those of us that aren't part of the mainstream industry, think of computers as always being correct. Story I tell in Glitch is the sad story of several cancer patients with fairly minor forms of cancer for which they're being radiated, and a company called Varian, that through a software glitch allowed the particle beams in these pieces of medical equipment to over-radiate both the areas of the body being targeted and massively overdose these patients, and many, many people died. Horrible, tortured, painful deaths. And I'm talking about that happening in the past year in this country, not in some third world, you know, sort of situation or years ago. It's in the here and now, and it's continuing to happen. And it's a sad story of our faith in computers and faith in the medical establishment and a software error, I'm sure innocently introduced, and the ramifications of it are tragic. It's happened with the likes of Toyota, with steering systems where the radius of the turn in some of their vehicles was inconsistent with the microelectronics that allow that to happen. You know, about 40% of the value in an automobile coming off the assembly line today, whether it's Toyota or a U.S. manufacturer or the Germans, is in the microelectronics and in the software and the electronic systems. And so the propensity of those kinds of problems to be introduced into the automotive industry or the healthcare industry now are, like much of the things we've talked about this morning, is becoming extreme.
And beyond the risks to life for a few individuals, I guess the next the bigger risk is this idea you raise about cyber terrorism and how our systems are putting us at risk for large-scale calamities based on faulty software that is being, targeted and misused by someone who wants to make a statement.
Well, and the scary thing is, my principal concern, and I interview in the book one of President Obama's, you know, experts on cyber terrorism. He's a brilliant guy. Recently did, a very well-conducted 60 Minutes interview. But the challenge is no longer the Matthew Broderick breaking in and changing his grade from a C to an A. The challenge is the Chinese government with whole ministries of people attacking Google's infrastructure because of issues of censorship. And, you know, the capacity for our information technology being stressed and strained with the growth and the mergers and the acquisitions and the complexity and the saturation we've discussed, now also having to stand up. I mean, I would venture to say that in the last 12 months is the first time that a major technology company like Google actually had to reach out to the federal government to get help from the National Security Administration in order to thwart cyber attacks on its own infrastructure. That's the scale of the quality that needs to be in place, given that we're no longer dealing with a kid in a dorm room or a terrorist in a cave in Afghanistan. We're talking about governments involved in the business of cyber terrorism.
You know, it's funny, it makes me think of an article I just saw today that was rather interesting about sort of the new form of protest. And they brought up even the 4chan voluntary botnet. So you can now voluntarily use your machine to join in a botnet to attack the MPAA and RIAA over takedowns on file sharing.
Yeah, no, there have been well-documented instances. That's a good example. There was an instance just as I was wrapping up the final chapters to the book where there was a let's call it the first digital lynch mob, where a particular individual, sick of the sort of problems with the lack of robustness in AT&T's network, which obviously was being strained by the popularity of the iPhone, convinced a bunch of people online that on a particular day, everyone was to turn on all of their sort of information intensive search applications in order to break AT&T's network completely and make a public display of how poor job yes. AT&T was doing. And actually, the federal government had to intercede because of the risk to the 911 system. So, you know, we had our first digital, you know, lynch mob of a major corporation in the case of AT&T, and we came very close to that network being taken out of consumer frustration. You know, it's both your example and mine are great examples of the massive degree of technology saturation we're talking about.
Well, and it's interesting because the numbers are just so huge. The ease at which they were able to do that and get it going, and once the sort of viral aspect kicks in, it starts to become a pretty amazing force out there on the internet. And then, like you say, the aspect that we're all relying on it and using it, you know, just even further complicates things. And at that point, who knows what else you've brought down? You know, you think about, in that case, where do the RIAA share hosting facilities with who else is in that premises? And now this distributed denial of service attack takes down that ISP or that data center. What other services are knocked offline and wiped out? That's that,
oh, it's
that
amazing.
Cascading effect.
Well, and think about all this in the context of cloud computing. You know, that's our industry is so prone to sort of cycles and acronyms and the latest sort of fads. And you know, cloud computing intellectually makes a ton of sense because it's no different back than when we used basically outsourced what we all called payroll to ADP. I mean, that was, in a sense, if you think about it, you know, going back 20, 30 years, that was the first form of cloud computing. It took a very specialized discipline that none of us wanted to be, you know, sort of domain experts at, and you threw it over the wall to ADP, and it's still a big business, and probably a lot of us knowingly or unknowingly use it. Well, cloud computing is taking a lot of applications and infrastructure for lots of mid-sized companies outside of our firewalls, and in the advent of cases like you're describing, something goes down, it leads to something else going down, and with the amount of applications populating these clouds, you have no way of even understanding what potentially we're taking off the air.
Yeah, more and more applications are relying on third-party data, third-party services, and other things to even function. I mean, we're going to a much more interconnected world, not away from it.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So given that, and you know, all of the problems that we're facing, you have a few ideas in the book about what you think we ought to do to move our way out of this problem. You want to talk about some of those?
Well, I talk about a number of things, and I'm in a couple of them are a little bit whimsical, admittedly. I talk about an IT government manifesto where I make the supposition that perhaps even the federal government, God forbid, needs to start, you know, sort of insisting on a certain level of certification or automation or quality for some of our most critical pieces of infrastructure, because, you know, to the point of our medical examples, you know, the consequence of failure is not simply inconvenience, it's life or death. A lot of Toyota's brand damage and well-publicized, you know, problems sort of, you know, fall into a like category. So the federal government, not all that long ago, I was an advisor along with other industry peers like Bill Gates and at the time Scott McNeely and others, when we were arguing with the federal government about things like encryption export controls and what encryption strength we could or couldn't export. We need to go back and work with our own governments now to insist on some form of, you know, kind of overarching sort of quality assurance for at least mainstream portions of our critical pieces of infrastructure. So I think we're reaching the point where technology is so critical to our economy, so critical to our consumption, so critical to our safety that there ultimately is going to be some variance of forms of regulation. to my earlier point, secondly, I make the point that it's time to think about automated forms of government and codified best practices. And, you know, innovation is kind of a way through this maze. And that, oddly enough, means we're going to have to do more sharing. And that's hard in the business world, given all of the competitive, you know, Venn diagrams that sort of exist between companies. But, you know, we've got everything involved here from open source technologies that are exposed to sort of common pieces of sort of middleware that we're all dependent on. And, you know, can't we all kind of collaborate and find ways to sort of, you know, automate the policy libraries that will provide us with the quality insurance that make it more possible for us to sort of exist and maintain the massive amount of technology that we're caring for? Because we're not going to have enough arms and legs to do it manually.
So when you talk about IT governance, and this is a concept that, you know, CIOs and IT managers surely understand, at least anybody who's been paying attention over the last decade. But, you know, when you look at a software developer, and you know, often the IT, big IT shops actually don't have a lot of hardcore software developers, right? They clearly have to have some people who program, but they outsource a lot of things and they, you know, buy a lot of things and integrate them and other things. It's not clear that the average software developer thinks a lot about the idea of IT governance, and many of them would probably chafe at it. They might be turning this podcast off even as we talk. What makes that palatable? How do we work that into the culture?
It's a really good question, because the odd thing is everybody wants governance, but nobody wants to be governed. It's
right.
It's kind of the ultimate sort of big brother conundrum in a sense. And, you know, increasingly we have large numbers of programmers and smaller numbers of architects. What really needs to happen here when you think about IT governance, and IT governance is more than just a software framework or a policy library. It really involves the business management right from the CEO's office of the company down, insisting on a linear and useful degree of standards and best practices that are part of the company's strategy, not just a package or a particular sort of technology substrate. So, you know, and we've come a long way in this regard, I have to say. I mean, you know, the CIO is no longer that sort of funny guy in the other part of the building that nobody can understand. I mean, they're mainstreamed, right? But now the crisis, if you will, is reaching a proportion where the leadership that says, you know, you are going to be governed. We aren't going to allow you to submit, you know, code to source control systems that has not been through an automated governance framework, because none of us are that infallible. That's a direction and an edict, if you will, that I think requires, you know, business leadership, not just tools and pieces parts. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah, I like that. I think that, like you say, CIOs are no longer kind of relegated to the outside circle, but I think we still have a lot of CEOs, boards, other division directors. I mean, you know, SVP of sales or whoever, who don't look at IT necessarily as this place where things could not just go horribly wrong. I mean, they often think of it as, well, if we can get our IT right, that's going to help us sell more or, you know, help us do better as a business. But they don't necessarily think, even with Toyota's experience, that, wow, if I don't watch this and pay attention to it, it could kill my business.
Well, and that's the point of glitch. You know, the real reality is that the ramifications of continuing to be casual about this and hope for the best, you know, aren't about marginal productivity increments anymore. It's about brand damage and a loss of service, or let's call it market-facing capacity outside our firewall that literally can end your business. And we're reaching a point in the maturation of our industry where that's how high the stakes have become. And the examples of failure, as we've been discussing this today, are in the broadcast news cycles every day.
Yeah.
Obviously, you wrote the book because you know, you kind of saw this issue and it was stuck in your craw, as it were. Did writing the book make you more hopeful, less hopeful? Did you start out pessimistic and become optimistic, or what happened?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think busy industry executives and CEOs write books when you're sort of really compelled to write books. I mean, the last book I wrote, Enterprise.com, I wrote when I was the CEO of Lotus, and I swore I'd never write another book again because, you know, writing a book always sounds like a kind of fanciful thing until you do it the first time and realize just how much work it is. It is a bit cathartic, and it allows you to exercise, you know, kind of a thought completely, because there's so much research involved. I started writing Glitch because, as somebody who's, let's face it, made an enormous amount of money and benefited, at least in a financial sense, in an extraordinary way from a career in this industry, I care about the industry and I care about everything that we've done for, you know, the economy and for consumers. And I'm concerned that my legacy not end with, you know, the kind of BP-style disaster in a digital sense that we're seeing in the Gulf.
That's a great metaphor.
And which probably, by the way, had as much to do with the technology associated with, you know, the fail-safe systems that did or didn't work. But as I researched the book and talked to other CIOs and at Ford and BP and other things, I became more hopeful, not less, that I wasn't the only one staying awake at night aware of the magnitude of the problem. Hopefully what I've done is bring together a collection of facts and trends and economics that make the scale of the pending storm graphically and interestingly available to people, and that makes the solution, as we've been discussing, more viral, because this is a problem of such monumental proportions that we're going to have a small army of thought to solve it, not just one bright guy in any particular book. But, you know, hopefully this can boil the idea at the surface.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. You make a great case for the size of the problem in the book. And I, too, hope that we can have more dialogue about this and solve the problem before it becomes out of hand. It's been a good conversation. I appreciate you coming on, Jeff.
Great. I appreciate the time and the provocative questions.
Thanks, guys.
Fascinating book. Thanks.
You've been listening to Technometria. For more of Technometria, please visit my weblog at www.windley.com.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. Our website editor was Joel Cherney. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
My name is Phil Windley, and I hope you join me next time for another edition of Technometria on IT Conversations.